If we can begin with a Surah Fatiha for the thawab of all the marhumeen, especially my father-in-law, his brother who passed away in Birmingham in England, was buried today, for his thawab, and also for marhum Sajjad Karim, who was my host in Leicester during Muharram 3 years ago, who a young man with three children who just passed away and was buried yesterday in Leicester in the UK, for both of them and for all of the marhumeen from our families and our communities. Surah Mubarakatul Fatiha, please. Before I begin, I just want to make a couple of announcements, or not announcements, but just a few clarifications. The previous Thursday when I delivered the talk, I mentioned when we're looking at Surah Ar-Rahman, chapter 55, and verse number 6, 7, and 8, which ended with the word Al-Mizan, I had incorrectly mentioned that, well, to my recollection, that was the only chapter of the Quran that had that repetition in it of the last word being repeated. Pretty much as soon as I got off the member, I received a WhatsApp from one of the young participants in the audience who was watching online, and they corrected me that Surah An-Nas, the very last chapter of the Quran, has a similar repetition where Allah repeats the word An-Nas 5 out of the 6 verses in that particular chapter. So I stand corrected. There are at least those two, Surah Rahman, again, the very first verses, verse 6, 7, and 8, that repeat the word Al-Mizan, the balance, and Surah An-Nas, which repeats the word An-Nas in 5 of the 6 verses. Salwa ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim, bismillahir rahmanir rahim, alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wassalatu wassalam ala ashraf al-anbiya wa sayyidil mursaleen wa habibi ilahil alameen, Abil Qasim Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Thumma salatu wa salamu ala ahli baytihi tayyibin tahirin al-ma'asumin al-madhulumin al-muntajabin la siyama maulana wa sayyidi sahib al-asri wa zaman ruhi wa arwahu al-alamin lahu al-fidah wa ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif wa la'natu da'imatu ala a'daihim wa munkiri fada'ilihim ilalani ila qiyami yawmiddin amma ba'd rabbi shrah li sadri wa yassir li amri wa halul uqdatan min lisani yafqahu qawli. For the hastening of the return of our 12th Imam, Imam Al-Hujjah, one salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Let me begin by first off extending our congratulations to all of us who are here tonight as we gather to mark the birth anniversary of the daughter of Ali and Fatima, alayhimu salam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. The one who has been given accolades such as Sharikatul Hussein, the partner of Al-Hussein, the one who was known as Aqilatul Bani Hashim, the one who was the intellectual one from amongst the Bani Hashim, and that is none other than Zainab bint Ali, alayhim wassalatu wassalam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. And it's a bit ironic that tonight being my second last lecture in Edmonton, because as you know, my contract expires in a few days, and I'll be moving back home to Ontario. And when I was looking at my calendar, I realized that the second lecture that I delivered in Edmonton 2 years ago actually happened to be the birth anniversary of Lady Zainab alayhi salam. And tonight is the second last lecture, and I'm leaving with this last or second last lecture about the same lady that we marked 2 years ago. Tonight, I want to look at an aspect of her life, as the title says, that Zainab bint Ali, she's a leading woman and a woman leader. Now, what do I mean by this in the preamble? Now, when we look at the lives of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim wassalam, unfortunately, and I've said this before, but I feel it's worthy to repeat it. Unfortunately, when we study the lives of the Prophet, not even the previous prophets, but even our final messenger, or the lives of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim wassalam, the infallibles and the non-infallibles, unfortunately, history has not been fair to these individuals. Now, we know that there is very little written. We have very little historical records from the time of Rasulullah. Most of these biographies that were written about the messenger were obviously much after his passing away. When we look at the lives of Lady Zahra and Amir al-Mu'mineen, each of the imams and their children of the imams, especially those that played a very prominent and upfront role in various Islamic movements, we see even lesser written about them. Obviously, one of the reasons is the fact that at that time, it seems that people did not give a lot of importance to historical narratives. Yes, they were recording the hadith of Rasulullah, how he walked, how he talked, how he brushed his teeth, how he entered gatherings. We know these very, you know, these sorts of aspects. But if you try to drill down deep into the lives of these individuals, we find very little, right? And when you look at the lives of the ladies from the Ahlul Bayt, like Lady Fatima Zahra alayha salam, like her daughter Lady Zainab alayha salam, like Fatima Al-Qum, Fatima Ma'suma, Lady Fatima Ma'suma Al-Qum alayha salam, there is even less about these individuals. One of the reasons could be because of the fact that they were women. They did not have a lot of outside interaction. There was not a lot of communication that they had or that other ladies were narrating about them. That may have been one of the reasons. But ultimately, again, we see that history has done an injustice to these individuals. And ultimately, when history does an injustice to them by not recording their narrative, their life, their stories that they have gone through in life, that makes us all the less able to appreciate their history, to really know what was going on in the lives of these individuals, especially because of the fact that we always claim that these individuals are role models. They're examples for us. We tell our sisters, look at the hijab of Lady Fatima if you want to model your hijab after hers. But if we don't know about her hijab, if it's not recorded, how do we give this back? We tell them about, we say to lead examples of the lives of these people, but when they're not recorded, it is basically an empty statement that we make. And so even tonight, when I was looking at the life of Lady Zainab alayha salam, there is a lot of ambiguity. You know, from the time of her birth, there is confusion. When was she married? There is a difference of opinion amongst our scholars. What happened post-Karbala, there's obviously a lot of difference amongst the scholars, and even where she's buried. Multiple opinions exist today. You know, where is she buried in northern Iraq? One opinion. Is she buried in Medina? Is she buried in Syria, in Damascus? Is she buried in Egypt? Are there other locations maybe that she might be buried? A lot of ambiguity surrounds these individuals and these personalities. And so that's the first point I want to mention. But obviously that doesn't detract us from the fact that she is a historical figure. She lived. We know certain snippets of her life. We know things that she had gone through. And obviously we try to delve lessons from those examples of her life to see what can fit and resonate with our time and our lives today. I want to present just a very brief outline before I go to my main theme tonight, of her being not only a leader amongst women, but a female leader. Just as a very brief recap of her life. And as again, we see that these are just the main milestones or highlights in her life. Obviously, much could be talked about in each stage, things that we are available in our sources. But we know that she was born either in the fifth or the sixth year after the Hijrah. So obviously, she lived to see Rasulullah, she lived to see her mother, Lady Zahra alayha salam. And obviously she was born after the migration at a time when Islam had now been established in Medina. Obviously a few years later, the Fath of Mecca, the victory of Mecca would take place. And that would open up another turning stone in the life of the Muslim community. At the age of about six, she loses her grandfather Rasulullah, either by death or as some scholars narrate that he was poisoned and murdered. I don't want to get into that debate, but that was one of the realities. She also was there when her mother, Lady Fatima, delivered that Sermon of Fadak. And incidentally, if you ever read the Sermon of Fadak, which is available online in translation, you will see the text might be about 12 to 15 pages in a regular size font. Lady Zainab, at the age of six, was there, and she actually is the one who memorized the entire sermon, and we have it narrated through her. So you can imagine a six-year-old child, what level of intellect she's at, that she can sit in the majlis of her mother, Lady Zahra, a young child, and she can memorize a sermon, a khutbah, a majlis, which may have taken a half an hour to deliver, more or less. A child of that age with that mental aptitude and capacity and ability shows us that she's not an ordinary individual, right? That she's not just another kid running around the streets of Medina, right? Look at her parents, who they are. Amir al-Mu'mineen and Lady Zahra, peace be upon them. Her grandfather is Rasulullah. Her brothers are imams, right? She comes from this family of nubuwa, of messengership, of wilaya, of authority. So at the age of 6, she loses her grandfather, she loses her mother, and obviously she sees what happens to Lady Zahra with the miscarriage when she's attacked. She goes through that entire episode and ordeal. And then at about the age of 14, so about 8 years later, she gets married. And she marries her first cousin, Abdullah ibn Ja'far al-Tayyar. They're first cousins, and they get married. She's about 14. Historically, again, we don't know much about Abdullah. We do know that his family were the ones who made the first hijrah to Ethiopia, to Habash. And then many years later, when Rasulullah moved to Medina, that is when that community moved from Ethiopia to Medina. And they say that he was born around the time of the hijrah. So he would have been around 5 to 7 years older than Bibi Zainab alayha salam. So not a huge age difference between the two of them. As we know that she lives her entire life in Medina, that is at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen when he has not had the Khilafat given to him. And eventually when the Imam takes over the Khilafat after the death of the third Khalifa, we see that Lady Zainab alayha salam with her family and many of the community members, many of the Ahlul Bayt alayhum salam, they move with Amir al-Mu'mineen to Kufa. He establishes the Khilafat, he establishes his base of governance, and they move. And obviously she lives there for that period of about 5 to 6 years after the Shahadat of Amir al-Mu'mineen. What happens between Imam Hassan alayhi salam and the likes of Muawiyah and all of that sedition that happened that were aimed against the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. The entire family uproot and move back to Medina. So Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, Lady Zainab alayhim salam, their entire family, they pack up, they go back to Medina. And then they stay there. For the time of the time of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, she's there when he is murdered, when he's poisoned. She sees his corpse being showered with arrows. She's there during the time of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam. And then obviously once Imam Hussein finds out about the death of Muawiyah, that Yazid now wants the bayat, the oath of allegiance, that's when, as we see, that Lady Zainab alayhi salam, with the permission of her husband and the family, they make the trip from Medina to Mecca, and then obviously Mecca towards Kufa, being intercepted in Karbala. The tragedy of Karbala takes place in the year 61 after the Hijrah. And then 2 to 3 years after Karbala, she herself dies under mysterious circumstances. Some scholars call it poisoning. Some say, no, she was physically attacked, assaulted in Sham when they went back, and she was killed there. Again, there's ambiguity whether she's buried in Egypt, whether it's in Medina, whether it's in Sham in Syria. But nonetheless, in a nutshell, that's her life. But again, as I said, that there's not a lot that is known about her. And when there's not a lot known about her, obviously we are forced to look at the very few events that we have and try to take something from her life. You know, just today I was reading about leadership in Islam. And what do non-Muslims say about Lady Zainab alayhi salam? Because you would have to agree, right, that we here in this room tonight, we know the story of Karbala. We know that Lady Zainab, she sees obviously the death of, you know, Rasulullah in the beginning, Imam Hassan, she sees the death of her mother. In Karbala, she sees the death of her two children that are there. She sees the death of Abu al-Fadl Abbas, of her brother Sayyid al-Shuhada, of the companions, of the family. She sees all of this. She goes through all of that torture and torment and grief, and yet she shines like a shining star for personalities that we look up to. And so I thought, let me see what non-Muslims say about her. You know, because we have non-Muslims who have written about Lady Fatima Zahra alayha salam in glowing tribute. We have books written about many of the latter wives of the Prophet by non-Muslim historians. In fact, just today I came across an article on the History Channel. On the History Channel website, they had an article about Aisha, the wife of the Prophet. And they had a quotation in there where they said, in addition to being a wife of the Prophet and a religious scholar, they called her a brave warrior and a leader. It was a bit of a strange thing, but if you know the history of Aisha and her rising up, and they mention in the article that she waged a war against the rightful caliph of her time, Imam Ali alayhi salam. They mentioned the event. But I sat back and thought about that we, as followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam, we have a jewel like Lady Zainab. And yet, when non-Muslim scholars look at who a brave individual is within the female category of Muslims, who is a warrior, who is an intellectual, they don't look at Lady Zainab. They don't comment on the fact that she was giving, you know, tafsir of Quran to women in Kufa. They forget the fact that she sees 72 people in her family killed in one day, in one afternoon, in a few hours, and yet she maintains the composure that she's able to lead the family from Karbala to Kufa to Sham, to speak in the courtyard of Ibn Ziyad in Kufa, to address Yazid in Sham with a sermon which is so powerful that some scholars mention that might have been the reason why the Ahlul Bayt were allowed to leave Sham to go back to Medina. But yet they don't look at her in the light of a warrior, a brave female warrior, as a personification of valor, of bravery, of glory. They look to other people. And again, that brings back my point, is that the fact that we have a lot to do to dig out the treasures of Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam, to learn more about them, and then to give this information back to the society, Muslim and otherwise, because they're definitely lacking a role model like Bibi Zainab alayha salatu wassalam. Salu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Tonight, for the time remaining, I want to look at this topic of not only her as a leading woman, because we know that she is the leading woman within the history of Islam. Whether the other Muslims accept it or reject it is irrelevant. Whether the non-Muslims accept her or reject her is irrelevant for us. We know her personality. We know her character. We know her, all that she did post pre-Karbala and post-Karbala. And so tonight, in addition to looking at that aspect of her as having gone through all of that, but yet she shines and she comes out with this radiant personality that people cannot falter in the least, I also want to look at the topic tonight about leadership within the Islamic perspective. Given that she was the leader of that family, yes, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam was there. I don't downplay the role of the fourth Imam. Ultimately, he is the Imam, he is the leader. At the death of the one Imam, the next Imam becomes the authority of Allah upon the earth. He is the leader without a doubt. But without a doubt, Lady Zainab alayhi salam plays a very important role in leading at that crisis, in that particular time, when the fourth Imam, at one level, may not have had the full physical ability to deal with the situation. He obviously still maintained his imamat, his authority. He told Lady Zainab also at many times what to instruct the rest of the family to do. But we have to accept the fact that she herself is a leader and that we can take from that example. And so tonight I want to look at this topic of leadership. You know, in a faith like Islam, in the religion of Islam, and especially as the followers of Ali Muhammad alayhi wasalam, we realize that leadership is a crucial part of this religion. You start right at the top. Nubuwat, prophethood, rasalat, messengership. It's about leadership. It's not just giving a book and running away. The prophets, the messengers, they bring the teachings and then they guide the society. It doesn't stop there. Our principle of our usul ad-din is imamat, leadership. Again, an integral part of our understanding of Islam is that after the death of a prophet, there has to be leadership in the community. And that's why imamat becomes a continuation of the prophethood. Obviously, no revelation comes to an imam, but they are a leader in the spiritual and the temporal issues of this dunya, the world. They lead in that era, in that area. We know that leadership doesn't stop there, because with the ghaybah, the occultation of our 12th imam, As a following, a community of followers of Ahlul Bayt, we believe that there is leadership after the Imams. And that's why we all subscribe to the theory of marja'iyat. We all follow one particular marja. We pick one individual that we feel is the most authoritative, the most knowledgeable. And we take that person as our leader. And we don't even take that individual only in matters of ahkam. It's not just taharat and najasat, the cleanliness and praying and fasting. Even when you and I have social problems, we have marital problems, we have personal problems, many times we'll write to the marja and say, this is my problem, can you give me advice? So we look to the marja for leadership, for guidance, for that inspiration. And even then it doesn't stop, because when you continue down the chain, they have the wukala, their representatives. We use them as a means to get to the marja, because we don't always get to Najaf or Qum or wherever our marja lives. So the wakil becomes a form of a leader. And then we come down to our communities. We have leaders of Salatul Jum'ah. That person is called the Imam of the Jum'ah. Imam is a leader. Leader not in the sense of an appointed as our 12th Imam is, but they're appointed in that position of leadership, or they are somehow given that title. So leadership comes at all of these different levels within our religious scope. And then even in the secular world, we have our prime ministers, our premiers, our mayors, our city council members. Within our own Muslim community, we have international federations, we have national federations and organizations, we have local institutions, local groups that manage our day-to-day affairs. So we see that our entire religion is actually built upon a foundation of leadership. Leadership, it seems to be the entire basis of how Allah even puts a system in place. But the strange thing is that we very rarely speak about this concept. Right? And if we claim, as we always do, that Islam is a religion for every era, for every time, and that every issue of life is directed by Islamic teachings, then we have to ask ourselves a question. If the Quran or the Rasul, the messenger, is teaching us how to use the bathroom, would he not teach us who should be a leader in a community? If he teaches us how to brush our teeth, should we brush in a circular motion or up and down? Then shouldn't he teach us about how to lead a society? If the Prophet teaches us all of these very simplistic issues that our dentist could tell us, that our hygienist could tell us, that our doctor could tell us, that our financial planner could tell us, then doesn't it make sense that if leadership is such a pivotal aspect of the religion, such a foundational basis that Islam is built upon and our societies are built upon, then does it not make sense that we should be given guidance in all of these areas? And obviously the answer is yes. And so tonight I want to just take us down a few hadith, a few of the sayings of the Prophet and his family, where they give us the mode of guidance for a society. And we'll see, obviously, that there's much more to be said, but I'm just being very selective tonight in the terms of the hadith that I've chosen. And hopefully it'll give us a better overview of what our responsibility is in terms of leadership. Because as Rasulullah has said in the hadith, which all Muslims narrate, Shia and Sunni have the same hadith, that Rasulullah has been quoted as saying that kullukum ra'in wa kullukum mas'ulun an ra'iyatihi, that each of you is a shepherd and each of you is responsible for your own flock. Everybody in this room, every Muslim at one level or another is a leader. Now I don't mean a leader as in terms of in charge of 50,000 people or a million people. No, even if you're at home, if you're a mother, you're in charge of the home. If you're a father, you're in charge of the home as well. And if you're a mother, you're in charge of your husband as well as your children. So you're a leader in the level of the home. If you're a madrasa teacher, you're a leader because you're teaching students. You're teaching the next generation of Muslims. You're a school teacher in the system. You're again a leader. You're teaching students. You're in charge of them. That is your flock. That is your responsibility. And it goes all the way up. You're a member of the community, you're a member of parliament, you're at the topest, the highest echelons of government. Everywhere you become a leader. And so Rasulullah says that all of us are leaders, are in charge, and all of us are responsible for those people, those individuals that we are charged to look after. And this makes us all responsible for learning the rules of leadership, right? Whether it's just two people at home, a husband and wife, or whether you have five, six, seven kids running around the house, whatever responsibility you have, whatever role you have, at one level or another, you are responsible for those individuals. And as we have another hadith, that when you are responsible, that means that you will be accountable. So with responsibility comes accountability. And that becomes the challenge, is that how do you use that account, that responsibility you have? Because on the day of judgment, we will all be accountable to Allah. The person who was just a member of his family and maybe he had two or three people, to the top level of, you know, of administration and authority, all of these people will be questioned by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Salu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. One of the first things that we see in the hadith is this understanding that leadership of power, of authority, is not something that people should crave. Right? It's not something that people should desire to want to be in. Because when you realize that you have a responsibility and you're going to be standing in front of Allah on the day of judgment, and Allah will ask you, you had power, you had authority, what did you do with it? When you think about it in that way, you're standing in the presence of Allah on the day of judgment. Forget about your own actions, your sins, everything that you've done. Now Allah will say, you were given power, you're given authority, you're given a mandate. How did you fulfill that mandate? It becomes a bit of a nerve-wracking situation to be in. And that's why we see in the hadith that we have, this one from Imam Radha alayhi salam as an example, where he tells us that actively seeking leadership is not a worthy trait to have. As he says, that the dangers which can manifest in our iman and the faith of a Muslim who is actively seeking power, authority in a community, in a society, in a country, he says it's much more dangerous than two wolves, that they could inflict damage on a group of sheep who have nobody to take care of them. We have that saying in English that power corrupts. An absolute power corrupts absolutely. Right? This is a reality. You look at people who are the heads of state, right? When Saddam started, took over power in Iraq, did he really think that he would be the madman that he turned out to be? Killing, gassing his own people, the Kurdish people? Killing people just for looking the wrong way? Killing people for not, you know, giving him the honor which he felt he deserved? Maybe he didn't have that at the back of his mind when he took over. But when he took over that power and he gets that feeling, that euphoria of being in charge, guess what? You do anything now to retain that authority. And again, absolute power corrupts absolutely. We see this in the world today. Many of the dictatorial countries in the world, whether it be the Far East or the Middle East, that power can destroy an individual. And so we see in the hadith that this power seeking, it can destroy our iman. Now you'll say, well, how do you elect people then? If nobody's going to run for president or prime minister or city council or whatever other positions, how do people actually take over the reins of leadership of any of these levels? And obviously one of the ways is when a person has that humility and humbleness in themselves. When they say that they don't want the position, but if there's nobody else available, they're willing to try and attempt to fulfill that requirement of the community. When people will come to an individual and say, look, we need a leader. We need somebody to come and help us. Why don't you come and step in and we'll give you the support? This is what they did at the time of Sayyidah Shuhada. When the Kufans wrote to Imam Hussein, they said, we need a leader. We need somebody to come and help us. And so as we know that Imam Hussein sends Muslim ibn Aqil as his emissary, and we know the tragedy that unfolded when they accepted him and then they unfortunately rejected him at the end of the day. But as the Imam says, is that when a person actively seeks this leadership, that's where the damage comes in. That's where their own faith is challenged, their own iman is challenged. Because now they feel that they're a somebody, that they have power in a community, in a government, in a household. And they feel that they can push their weight around, not realizing at the end of the day that they are again responsible. They are taking care of a flock. and that Allah will question them on the day of judgment. The second aspect of leadership is, how do we govern? We can't deny the fact that Rasulullah was ma'asum, infallible. He does not make mistakes. He could make mistakes. He's not protected in a bubble. But Allah gives the anbiya, the mursaleen, a level of knowledge and awareness that they don't make the right, they don't rather make the wrong judgments in life. They know what to do in every instance. But yet when you look at the life of Rasulullah, the battle of Khandaq comes along, the battle of the trench, and rather than Rasulullah saying that this is what we will do, he took advice from the Sahaba, from the community companions. And Salman comes and says, in our day, when we had a war, we would dig a trench around the city, which would prevent an onslaught of the enemy to come in. So Rasulullah says, what a great idea, let's do the same thing here. It wasn't that Rasulullah didn't know. Of course not. He knew the best military technique to use. But he was showing us that, look, when you're in a position of authority, whether you're the CEO, you're a team lead, you're a manager, you're whatever you are, you're the principal of a school, you're the teacher in the school, take advice from other people. As the Imam says, Imam Ali says, look at what is being said. Don't look at who is saying it. Right? Sometimes a young person in the community might come with a brilliant idea that makes sense, but because the older people who are in charge are of a different mindset, they may not have thought about it. And they may think, well, that's a great idea. Why don't we do that in our community? Why don't we change tactics in our business and do this way? And at the same time, sometimes we go to people because we feel they're seniors, they're elders, we have to respect them, fine. But that doesn't mean just because they've been around the block, because they know they've been through a community for 30, 40, 50 years, it doesn't necessarily mean that they know everything. But as Amir al-Mu'mineen says, look at what is being said. If a young 12-year-old kid comes and says, you know what? This is how you do things on social media. Why don't you try and do this? This is what me and my friends like to see on social media. Take their input. They know better. Listen to them. Give them a forum, a platform that let the youth come and say that this is how we do things in our group, in our school, in our friends. Why don't you try this? Many times we discount the youth, or what do they know? They're young kids, they're immature, they're inexperienced. They don't know how to run an institution, a business, a community. No, maybe those youth can teach us a thing or two. As I said at the beginning, last week in my lecture, I made a comment. I had a 14-year-old girl correct me that no, there are other ayat that have that same repetitive nature. I learned from her. I'm not going to say that I know everything, no, because we don't know everything. Nobody knows everything except for Allah. He is all-knowing, He is al-alim. Everybody else, prophets, imams, we all have to learn from Allah. So tradition number two, point number two is take the advice, take the guidance when it comes. Look at who's giving it. Don't look at who's giving it, look at what they're saying. Does it make sense? Can it be implemented? Is it logical? Is it practical? You know, weigh everything and then come up with a conclusion. The third point about leadership for tonight is, who do we put into power? And who do we surround ourselves with? When Imam Ali alayhi salam sent Malik al-Ashtar, a very powerful individual, a very decisive, brave warrior, statesman, politician, whatever you want to call him, and he gave him that magnum opus, that letter that Imam Ali wrote, that 50-page letter that Imam Ali wrote, which till today, the United Nations has told the Arab governments that if they want to have a stable society, that they should follow Imam Ali's guidance. This 50-page book of guidance from Imam Ali, when Imam Ali gave it to Malik al-Ashtar, he knew what he was talking about. And there's so many lessons in there for leadership that it just baffles the imagination that 1400 years ago, a man could write such a document that till today, an international body can recommend Muslims to read, Muslim governments to read and to implement. And if they are recommended to read it, if Imam Ali sent Malik to Egypt with this letter to implement it, then I think it behooves us, his followers, before we decide to take on a leadership position, or we are given that position, or we're encouraged to take that position, that we sit and read this letter and think about it, every line of what Imam Ali told Malik. One of the things Malik is told is Imam Ali says that when you get there, you have this government, you're going to put people into different ministries and positions of office and of importance. He says that make use of those who are righteous people, who come from noble, respectable families, and have a solid, proven track record. That's a key point, is choose people that can get the job done, that have proven it in the past, that they know what they're doing. You know, we live in a world today where one of the things that happens in dictatorial regimes is nepotism. You know, the king of this country will have his son or his brother or his nephew in power, and then all the princes get to come on board as well and ride the gravy train. They get to be in this ministry and that ministry and this account and that portfolio. They're not looking at, is this person worthy of the job? Does he have a proven track record? Has he displayed the competencies, the core competencies that are needed? No, because he's family, he leads. That's where we see a lot of the problems happening, not only in Muslim society, but even in, I'm sure, non-Muslim societies, this also comes about. Right? The Imam shows us to look for people who are righteous. If you have a religious organization, it stands to reason that you should have religious people in charge. Right? If you are in a law firm and you're a lawyer and you have the entire law industry, or you're the lawyers that are in charge, or the lawyers that have a group or association, chances are there will be other lawyers who are on that board representing. And so if there's a Muslim organization, they have to be people who are not just Muslim by name, but Muslims also in character, in the way they carry themselves, in their akhlaq, in their demeanor, the way they talk to their members, right? Proven track record. They have to be somebody that's proven to do things. Sometimes people say, we want to bring new blood into the organization. Great, bring the new blood. Let the youth come on board. Let other people come on, train them, teach them. But don't kick out the other people who have been there for 20, 30, 40 years doing a job, and you say, well, we want new people. We want qualified. We want trained people. We want people who know what they're doing. Maybe they might know from a paper point of view. They've got a degree from University of Alberta, or they've got some coursework under their belt, but they're still fresh off the block. They don't have experience in that area. Bring them on board as apprentices, job shadowing, train them in the position. But don't just kick everybody out and say, we want new blood. We don't want the old people anymore. Out with the old, in with the new. That's not leadership. That's just pure insanity. To bring people on board who don't know and remove the people who do know the ropes. And so that's another point in leadership. And then Imam Ali goes on, and I'll conclude in the next couple of minutes, is when Imam Ali wrote to his workers, he made a very deep statement. And I still sit and read this and think about what level of profundity that Imam Ali was thinking at. So he tells his officers, people who are scribes, let's say, in the company. We don't have scribes today. Everybody has their own smartphone. They'll just shoot out a text message or an SMS or an email, and you get done with it. But he was talking at a time when the mode of communication was paper and pen. When your pen wasn't a Bic pen bought from the dollar shop, it was a tree that you would have to cut down, a particular tree, a branch, to make a pencil. And that would wear out after time, and you'd have to make ink and use that ink. That was the time Imam Ali was speaking about. But the point is not the instruments, but the philosophy behind it. He says that sharpen the points of your pencils. Write your sentences close together. Do not waste the office supplies. That's a paraphrasing it. And remove any extra information in what you write, which does not have to be written, and only write that which is necessary. And above all of this, I advise you to keep away from writing too much unnecessarily, since the wealth of the Muslims cannot put up with wastage. Now you think about that. At a time 1400 years ago, to get a pencil, all you'd have to do is find a tree, cut a branch, right? Maybe the government might have to pay for those trees to water them for them to grow. You'd grow the tree, you'd cut a branch, you'd make a pencil, get some ink, and you'd use that to write. But yet Imam Ali was making a few very subtle points. Sharpen the tips, meaning that make sure that your pencil, that branch is so fine that you're not wasting, using too much ink in the writing. Write the sentences close together. Don't waste the office supplies. Generally speaking, in today's terminology, it would be like, you know, don't just go and take stuff from the office cupboard where office supplies are and just, you know, use a piece of paper, you write a word and you throw it away in the recycling bin. You take pens from work because they got an extra collection of pens. So if I take two home, it's okay, it's not a problem. Right? Imam Ali was showing that when it comes to even writing a letter, don't waste the supplies of that government, because this is coming from the money of the Muslim community. And as he says, the Muslims can't afford to use or deal in wastage. We have to ask ourselves that same question when we become leaders. Are we wasting money? Are we just throwing money away when it shouldn't be wasted? Do lights stay on in a community or in a center and people don't bother turning the lights off? Ah, it's only a few pennies a day. It's an LED light bulb, so who cares? Really, who cares? This is the 12th Imam's money we spend. And if we say, who cares? It's only a few dollars for a light bulb left on or the water faucet left on for a few days. It's not a big deal. $10 water bill, I'll put it out of my own pocket. The point is that Imam Ali is making a statement that you can't waste money. You can't waste anything. Even in our own homes, we shouldn't be wasting water, electricity, you know, all of these things we're accountable for. But imagine now you take that at the level of the house of Allah. And you say, ah, it's okay, we'll just get more donations in next month. We'll ask that donor who's rich, he'll give another 50,000. We'll pay off our expenses and our bills. Imam Ali could have said the same thing. He could have said, we've got a lot of money coming in from this country, from there. We've got homes coming in, zakat, sadaqat. We can put all this money in. We can have nice stationery in the government of Imam Ali. Why not? But he says, look at the pencils. Look at how much you write on the paper. Don't write extra that you don't have to write. Be very frugal when it comes to these issues. Don't think that money is an endless supply. It's not endless. One day people will stop donating. One day people will get tired of wastage, of things being broken, of things being spent, of you know, things being done that don't need to be done. And they'll cut off the supply. They'll say, we're not going to give anymore. We don't have that. You know, we'll give somewhere else. We'll give overseas. We'll give to orphans, to widows. We're not going to waste our money where people don't care about it. And so Imam Ali shows us, again, another step of leadership that we have to be aware of this. And last, and I'll conclude with this for tonight, is where the Imam actually points to taking in money, of how to develop a budget. Right? He says, a person who merely focuses on the collection of taxes and neglects the fertility of the land, talking about a government where all they do is tax, tax, and tax, like we have here in Canada. This tax, that tax, something else comes up, they want to tax it again. They tax us on all of our purchases, then they want to, you know, bring all of these different taxes in place. But they don't worry about how can the people pay all of this when our wages don't go up in a similar fashion to the tax rates, income tax, and all of these things. Imam Ali says, whoever focuses only on collecting taxes and they neglect the fertility of the land, what can be built, developed, infrastructure, they lay waste to the land and consequently they ruin the state and bring about destruction to the servants of Allah, and their rule will definitely not last a long time. Again, Imam Ali is showing us that it's not always about the money. Right? It's good for a community, for a society, for a group of people to be financially independent, that we don't have to worry who will pay the bills for next month, or who will pay this, or who will pay that. But when our entire goal is just raising donations, taxing, you know, parking lot maybe one day, maybe we'll start taxing people to park closer, or maybe we'll start taxing like other religions do. If you want to pray in the first line, you have to pay extra. It sounds strange, but there are people in Ahlul Kitab today where they have a rule. If you want to sit in the front row of where the preacher is speaking, the more money you donate, the closer to the front you get to sit. It happens today in Canada. It's not far off in another country. It's here in North America. Some communities do this. Alhamdulillah, we don't have that in Islam, because your prayers would be void were you to do that. If you were to say, this musalla right here, this is mine, because I donated for this carpeting and I'm going to pray here every day, and if somebody comes, I'm going to kick him out because that's my spot. If you do that, your prayers are null and void. Nobody has a spot except for the person who leads, because he has to be or she has to be at the front of the hall. Everybody else has free rein. You can't come an hour early and say, I'm going to put my stuff here and nobody can move it. This is my spot. Yeah, if you're there early and you're praying there, okay, but you can't put your name on a plaque and say that is mine or that wall is mine. I donated for that part, so I'm going to sit against that wall and nobody can sit there. No, that's not how Islam works. That's not how connection to Allah works. And so any of those ways to raise money would obviously be a problem. As Imam Ali says, don't just worry about money coming in. If you're doing a good job, people will see it. People will want to donate. But if you're squandering, if you're wasting, if you're not giving back to people what they deserve, you're just getting money and then not giving back to the community. Then as Imam Ali says, he talks about it in the terms of fertility of the land and infrastructure and development. He says that don't expect your governance to be, you know, long term. You'll finish up your term and that'll be it. You'll be gone and people won't remember you. People won't say, well, this person was in charge X years ago and they did all of these amazing programs that brought the youth back to the center, that were concerned about the seniors, that were there for the women's programs. They'll just say they did a couple of things and they're gone and we don't even remember them. And there'll be no legacy left for people to remember those individuals about. And so as I conclude tonight, that we realize that this concept of leadership is something which Lady Zainab alayhi salam embodied in her life. She was the leader along with the fourth imam, and by the permission of the fourth imam, she led the family through all of those difficult times on the Sham-e-Ghariba, after the night of Sham-e-Ghariba, when they went to Kufa, all the way to Sham, she was leading the family at that time. She was speaking the truth in the face of injustice. She was giving a word to Yazid to make his dominion diminish and crumble away. And if we see that she was a leader of her time, that she led the revolution against Yazid and Banu Umayyah, which is evident from the fact that Banu Umayyah didn't last much long after the event of Karbala, we see that we should be able to try and take from the life of Lady Zainab, that she was a leader amongst the women, that our women also have to stand up and take a real role in leadership, to be leaders in many, many different levels, and that also we, the men and women, can learn from the leadership of Lady Zainab, and learn from the leadership given to us in the teachings of Ali Muhammad alayhi salam, that we can be that community that will be ready to welcome in the 12th Imam. That when the 12th Imam's advent takes place, which we hope and pray is soon, that we have strengthened ourselves, that we have put ourselves on the right path, that we have been able to lead ourselves and our community going forward towards the 12th Imam. We conclude and we ask Allah on this night that we marked the birth anniversary of Lady Zainab, the daughter of Ali and Fatima, peace be upon all of them, that Allah accept this act of worship from us tonight. We ask Allah that for all of us who have not yet had the tawfiq, have not been blessed to visit Sayyidah Zainab alayhi salam and her beautiful golden shrine in Damascus, we ask Allah that He allow us, give us the ability to make the ziyarah to her blessed shrine. We ask Allah to bring about peace and comfort and tranquility to the people of Syria and to the entire region of the Middle East who have been suffering under Daesh for the last many number of years. We ask Allah to forgive us all of our sins, to keep us all on the path of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. And we ask Allah, last but not least, again, once again, to hasten in the return of our 12th Imam, Imam Al-Hujjah, and that we can be of those to be able to help and assist and to guide those who are seeking rectification in their lives and to be guided towards the 12th Imam and to be guided towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. رَبَّنَا تَقَبَّلْ مِنَّا إِنَّكَ أَنْتَ السَّمِيعُ الْعَلِيمُ صَلُّ عَلَى مُحَمَّدْ وَآلِ مُحَمَّدْ